Before the show starts, I want to make an appeal to all you listeners that if you like what you hear on the SRB podcast, consider becoming a monthly sustainer on Patreon. Not only will you help this podcast continue to move forward, you will now get a little something in return. You will join the table of ranks of the SRB empire. For a monthly contribution of $1 to $4, you'll be given the rank of collegiate registrar and receive an SRB podcast refrigerator magnet. For $5 to $9, you'll be named Collegiate Secretary and get an SRB podcast shot glass and all the privileges of lower ranks. For $10 to $24, you'll become a Collegiate Counselor and will receive a promo code for 30% off of books from the University of Pittsburgh Press and all the privileges of lower ranks. And for $25 or more, you'll be anointed a Chancellor and will be sent a set of 4 SRB podcast shot glasses and all the privileges of lower ranks. Join the table of ranks and help me give you in-depth discussions about Russia and the wider region that you won't find anywhere else by clicking on the Patreon button on seansrussiablog.org. Now on with the show.
Как-то вечерком с милой шли вдвоем, а фонарики горели. И при виде их на момент притих, и сердца наши замлели.
Hello and welcome to the SRB podcast, where in each episode we discuss Eurasian politics, culture, and history. I'm your host, Sean Guillory. Before we get started today, I want to make a request to all my listeners who use or are thinking of using the podcast for their courses. If you're one of those, could you please drop me a line via email, Facebook, or through the podcast website with your course and the institution you're teaching at? Also, if you can give me a sense of how you're using the podcast and students' reactions. This information will be quite helpful for potential funding. Thanks. What is custom, and what does it mean to do something according to custom, especially to settle disputes or regulate behavior? How does customary law mesh with civic and religious law? Namely, what gives custom its power? Judith Baer takes up these questions in her new fascinating book on the role of custom, elder courts, authority and respect, and ritual in everyday life in Kyrgyzstan. Judith Baer is professor of anthropology at the University of Konstanz, Germany, where she focuses on the anthropology of the state, legal pluralism, and theories of social order in Central Asia and Southeast Asia. She's the author of The Force of Custom, Law and the Ordering of Everyday Life in Kyrgyzstan, published by Pittsburgh University Press. Here's Judith Baer. Your book, The Force of Custom, Law and the Ordering of Everyday Life in Kyrgyzstan, is a really interesting and I would say quite intimate look at the role of custom and law in everyday life in that country. So I thought we'd start by having you talk about what inspired you to do this study.
So I wanted to do a PhD in anthropology and had been to Kyrgyzstan several times before my actual fieldwork. I studied in the capital, Bishkek, for 6 months in the year 2003, studied law and anthropology and learned Kyrgyz. And I think it was around that time that I encountered for the first time the so-called Aksakal courts, which you could translate as the courts of elders. Literally, it's the courts of the white beards. And I was intrigued by that institution. There was nothing written on that institution, but everyone knew who they were and what they were doing. And there was this particularly outrageous case of a stoning, apparently, in Talas province, which is the smallest province in Kyrgyzstan and located in the northwest. So I wanted to find out more about these courts and what kind of law they were applying. And this was basically the start of my fieldwork. And then during fieldwork, which took place between 2005 and 2006, so I was in the country for 15 months on end, I came to broaden the scope of my research. So I started out with investigating the Aksakal courts in these two rural villages where I lived and where I carried out my fieldwork. But I had not envisioned at that time to do a study on the force of custom. So the scope of the research broadened throughout fieldwork, as it mostly does in anthropology. And the Aksakal courts are still part of the book, but they're not so much in the center as they were when I set out to do the research.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because I found it striking, I haven't read a lot of anthropological work, but most of the anthropological work I've read always talks about how, at least there's a mention of anonymizing informants for a variety of reasons. And I found it interesting, in right in the beginning of the books, you state that you chose not to do this. You chose to keep the real names of your informants. And in fact, you state that your informants actually requested you keep their names because they see your study as part of their village history. So talk about your informants, the type of people that you engaged, your decision to name them, and how they understood what you were doing.
Yeah, I'm aware that it's still quite an unusual decision. And it was a decision I carefully thought about for a long time. The book is the third book which centers on these particularly two villages in Tellus. The first book I did was a photo ethnography, which I published right after having come back from fieldwork. So it came out in 2007, because I wanted to give back a type of publication which I knew would be of importance and would be considered valuable by my informants, who at that time, for example, didn't have access to a lot of photographs of themselves, which is something unimaginable in 2017, right? So 10 years later. But it was the case in 2007. So I made this book, which is full of photographs of these two villages and of people, and it gives an ethnographic account of their everyday life. And I brought this book to my host families, the people I lived with, all the people I worked with. There are copies in the local libraries and in the schools. And people were very, very happy to have that type of publication. So they were proudly showing it off to visitors and state officials who came by and so on. And then I did a second small publication together with my research assistant at the time, which is basically the oral history of my main informant, Bai Zepa, who is 90 years by now. And it's her story of growing up in Soviet times, raising 8 children as a single mother, working in the kolkhoz, having been a devout Muslim for over 50 years, so throughout the Soviet time, refusing to learn Russian or speak Russian, and managing her household and being a very important and central figure in the village. And I brought that book also back in 2010. And I brought, I think, 100 copies to the two villages, which I used as part of the local history courses